Issues Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are four levels of giving. The Confessor, $25 monthly, or an annual gift of $250. The Apologist, $50 monthly, or an annual gift of $500. The Reformer, $100 monthly, or an annual gift of $1,000. And the Patron, $200 monthly, or an annual gift of $2,000. Each Reformation Club member receives premiums like books, transcripts, and the I Have Issues t-shirt. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by contacting Craig. His email address, craig@issuesetc.org. Or you can call 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. I've been doing this program now for 10 years, and one of the subjects that we routinely deal with, sometimes we deal with it explicitly, sometimes it's woven into other conversations we have. It's amazing how often it does come up, are the so-called worship wars. Now, my theological bent, Lutherans are no strangers to the worship wars. Of course, it is not necessarily a denominational thing, but I have long experience with the conflict on both sides. Those who want to experiment, innovate, they say they're doing it for the sake of growing the church or reaching the lost. Those who say, no, what we have been given by Christians who have come before us, by the church of two millennia, by way of historic forms and texts for worship, are valuable because they do communicate the gospel to a lost world in a way better than any of our innovation or experimentation possibly could. And we'd be unwise and perhaps even violating Scripture to dispense with many of the things that the church has handed down to us. So, it's no big surprise that this would catch the attention of someone like Terry Mattingly. He's written recently about the Lutheran worship wars, along with articles about the New York Times and anti-Catholic bias in a new movie called The Invention of Lying. Terry Mattingly joins us for the last half hour. He's director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He writes a weekly column called On Religion for Scripps Howard News Service. He's founder of GetReligion.org, and he's author of the book Pop Goes Religion. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to talk to you.
Well, we've been doing this show for 10 years, and you write recently about the Lutheran worship wars. We've picked a side for the last 15 years of the show, and so it's no surprise to me that our most vocal critics, at least over my experience, my decade of experience with this show, have been Lutheran pastors on that very issue of the worship wars. Advocates of innovation and experimentation in the Lutheran worship wars say that this is the only way to make a congregation grow. What did you discover?
Well, let me tell you an anecdote. Back in the mid to late 90s, I was asked to be the keynote speaker, the final speaker, I should say, the closing speaker, at a conference on worship wars. And it was among the independent Christian churches, which is a free church Protestant denomination. And this guy got up and he said, now you need to understand that there are four kinds of worship in the modern church. The first, he said, is traditional. The second form is contemporary. The third form is blended, where you try to do a little of both. And the fourth form is liturgical, at which point I was cracking up in the back row for obvious reasons. And what is the obvious reason?
Well, I'm not sure. Tell me.
Okay, no, that was effectively done. I'm trying to goad you a little bit. Since when is liturgical?
I mean, you've already got my blood pressure up, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, note that traditional is different from liturgical, which means that the fact that something has been around in one form or another for 2,000 years doesn't make it traditional. For him, liturgical is a different school of worship than traditional. And I'm cracking up laughing in the back row because I can't get out of that. I mean, that just strikes me as hilarious, but then again, I'm Eastern Orthodox, right? So my point here is that you have to start off by trying to define what is traditional worship for most Protestants. Or in this case, what is traditional worship for even, you know, Missouri Synod Lutherans? Where are you going with that? The traditional worship, this person at this conference I was at, he said traditional worship is whatever the people who were running the church in the 50s and 60s say it is. because now they're the primary donors to the church. So traditional worship is whatever was in the hymnal and whatever was in the culture and whatever was the norm, basically in the American 50s and 60s when these people were young adults having their children and came into the church. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So where I'm going with all of this is that means that contemporary is actually the baby boomers, which means in the last chapter of my book is about post-contemporary worship, and the fact that now you have entire other generations now beginning to search for what comes after contemporary worship, and they're just splintering even more. But the last thing you want to do, if you want to, I mean, how old are the baby boomers now? I mean, I'm 55. My brother, who's 9 years older than me, was born at the start of the baby boom. He's, 64. So is that how you do church growth? I mean, you're going to do basically, happy, clappy worship for everybody who lost their hearing listening to the Eagles too loud? I mean, is that contemporary? Well, I'm rambling, but my point here is contemporary is always moving, which means that if you base your worship concepts on whatever is contemporary, you have no worship concepts that you can ever live by from generation to generation, and you inevitably carve the church up into kind of worship by FM radio, which means, you spin the dial and you hit, here's the praise and worship, here's the country band, here's the edgy, edgy metal Gen X, here's the people that want to sound like you too, here's the one, you know what I'm saying? You get all of these different styles. The New York Times did a piece a couple of years ago on a church outside of L.A. that has like 12 different rock bands. Everything from Hannah Montana for children's Sunday school, all the way up to traditional worship, which once again is hymn book, pipe organ, etc. But notice that the hymn book and the pipe organ is only from like when? 1940, 1950? So I'm thoroughly confused about all this, but it strikes me as interesting that in the Missouri Synod, it seems to me that you have a war going on between the 50s and 60s versus the 80s. And I'm wondering, first of all, where are we supposed to be now if you're a Missouri Synod Lutheran? And the guy I'm interviewing, of course, Philip Magnus, is saying that whatever happens, a church has to make its decisions together. Otherwise, you have separate congregations worshiping under the same roof, and you do not have a true Eucharistic sacramental body. But now you tell me, is that old Lutheranism talking? Or would the current leadership of the denomination have moved beyond that into a more Protestant understanding of how you define the church and the congregation anyway?
Well, I think, to answer your question, whether or not it is rhetorical, the current leadership of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, I think it's fair to say, hell-bent upon moving us in the direction of kind of a generic evangelical Protestantism in terms of our worship practices. And I wonder whether those things that are not simply tradition but biblical mandates from Scripture with regard to Christians gathering together on the Lord's Day, such as the public reading of Scripture, the prayers, I would take that to be the form of prayers, the breaking of bread, the apostles' fellowship, baptism. I wonder if those things can survive such a transition. What did Magnus discover as he looked at the variety out there?
Well, he found, of course, what he's doing is trying to create churches that want to leave the texts intact. You know what I'm saying? Whereas to him, whether you rearrange the music so that it can be sung by small churches or large churches, or you want to, I don't think he'd want pop arrangements of these things, but he's not one of those guys that's locked into the hymnal of the 50s. He thinks the congregation should sing new music and it should sing new arrangements and whatever, but his key is that you must leave the order of the service, the sacramental fabric of the service intact, and that you can't mess with the texts. And what he found is that the more people start experimenting, I'll actually read you a quote from him in the column, which is really not out yet. You're reacting to a column you saw running around online. It probably won't hit most American newspapers till Friday or Saturday at the end of this week. But there's a quote from him in here that goes something like this. I'm scrolling down to it. We have... What I found is that we're a lot like Forrest Gump's box of chocolates. And he's talking about the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. It says Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod on the sign, but when you go inside, you have no idea what you're going to get. Some of our churches are playing with the structure of the liturgy, and some are playing with the content. And our whole synod is trying to find out where to draw some boundaries. So for him, there's the issue of keeping the structure of the service intact. And what he has found is the more you start playing with the structure of the service, the more you then are tempted to begin messing around with the actual content of the texts. And I found that, you know, I'm not a Lutheran. I'm not a Missouri Synod Lutheran. I'm a convert to Eastern Orthodoxy. But, you know, that just starts shooting flares up in the air to me like all get out. When you've got a committee at your church meeting and trying to redraft a creed so that it goes better with the song, the pop song you're singing, I've got trouble.
We're talking Terry Mattingly. He is director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He writes a weekly On Religion column for the Scripps Howard News Service. He's founder of GetReligion.org and author of the book Pop Goes Religion. When we come back, we'll turn from a battle in the Lutheran Church over worship to a battle between Archbishop Dolan in New York against the New York Times and what he perceives as a very strong anti-Catholic bias. We'll see what Terry has to say about that spat on the other side of the break. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk live with former Miss California, Carrie Prejean. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for November is the Lutheran Study Bible. It's a resource for your family, for your church life. If you go to Bible study on a regular basis, this is the kind of study Bible you want to take with you. It arms you not only for the conversation, but you can learn either individually or corporately quite a bit from studying the scholarship therein. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Look for the Lutheran Study Bible or call Concordia Publishing House. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Lutheran Study Bible, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November. We know that many congregations are putting together their budgets for next year. Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. to your congregation's mission or advertising budget for 2010. Simply go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org, and find out more about the Issues Etc. 300. You'll even find a one-page flyer that you can hand out. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues Etc. The Issues Etc. 300.
Are you looking for a church where you can receive the gifts of God in the gospel and the sacraments and in the church's historic worship with lively music? Then come to Hope Lutheran Church in South St. Louis. We're located on the corner of Brannan and Neosho Streets at 5218 Neosho. You can also reach us on the World Wide Web at www.hopelutheranstl.org and give us a call at 314-352-0014. There is hope in St. Louis.
No consultants necessary. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The new Issues Etc. YouTube video features Benny Hinn.
Adam was a super being, that he had dominion over the fowls of the air, the fish of the sea, which means he used to fly. Adam not only flew, he flew to space. With one thought, he'd be on the moon.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play.
Joel Osteen.
You may have to weed through 100 negative thoughts before you come to the right sound. The voice of victory that's saying, you are blessed, you are prosperous, you can do all things, your best days are still ahead. Latch on to those thoughts.
Never heard the word impossible this time. There's no...
And Deepak Chopra.
How come you're all so convinced that God is a he and Satan is a he? How come we have these ideas that are so mythical, that are so primitive?
Check out the new Issues Etc. YouTube video at issuesetc.org and click support.
The media is always talking about how the Republican Party needs to shore up its base with the religious right. I don't know why they don't talk about how the Democrats need to shore up their base of unchurched agnostics and atheists.
It's like living a sanctified life. Does any one of us ever live the kind of sanctified life that we should? No. So does that mean we stop trying? Well, of course not. And that's the way I see closed communions. Just because we can't do it perfectly doesn't mean we should get rid of it.
It's one of the most critical votes we've had in the pro-life movement in many, many years, and they are just beside themselves. And so the long knives and the venom is coming out, and I'm a very unpopular person.
The left thinks that they can ride that tiger, that they can use them, and then they will be able to control them. They are very, very, very naive in that regard.
Just a taste of the sound bites of the week that we have lined up for you tomorrow on Issues Etc. We'll play Sound Bite of the Week. It's a very easy game we play every week here on Issues Etc. We pick four sound bites from Issues Etc. audio of this week. We play them for you. They're also available at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on demand. We play them for you on the air, and then we want to hear from you. You vote for Sound Bite of the Week. Your reasons are your own. But you just give us a call, 1-877-623-6943, or email us, talkback@issuesetc.org. We'll play Soundbite of the Week tomorrow on Issues Etc. Terry Mattingly is our guest. Terry, you wrote recently about a spat between Archbishop Dolan in New York and the New York Times, and he is accusing the New York Times of anti-Catholic bias. What did he read there, and what was his response?
Well, he read several things, and he basically accused the New York Times of anti-Catholicism, of bigotry. And I thought, frankly, he put all this up. He wrote the piece and sent it to the Times. To no one's surprise, they refused to run it. But in this day and age, all that means is you offer it to somebody else, and you run it yourself on a blog, at which point you start getting press coverage of it, right? I mean, that's the way modern church leaders can go. So he was mad at a lot of things, but primarily he was mad at a column by that eminent Catholic theologian Maureen Dowd, who wears her kind of not only her left wing Catholic perspective, but the fact that she wears this kind of naughty Catholic schoolgirl thing, you know, on her sleeve like a badge of honor. And that just ticked him off. I mean, this column she wrote has every single negative stereotype of Catholicism that you can possibly have in it. He also was upset that there was a story, for example, on Orthodox Jews and their problems with sexual abuse by their leadership and even by their clergy. And he thought it was interesting that the Times wrote about that without making the same demand, say, of Orthodox Jews that they would make of Catholics, that they should drop all statutes of limitations, that there should be total transparency on the documents, etc. What I thought was more, the other of his many complaints, the other one that I thought was most significant, because this is something I've been interested in for years, he contrasted the amount of ink that has been spilled on the Catholic clergy sexual abuse, which, by the way, in my opinion, has not received enough coverage of substance. But he contrasted the fact that there's been tons of coverage of that with almost no coverage of the similar scandals involving public schools and teachers and administrators in public schools, where the rates of sexual abuse of children are as high as they are in the Catholic Church, or perhaps higher in some cases. He thought that was simply unforgivable, that they continue to pound away on Catholics on these issues but aren't holding other people up to the same status. He accused them of, let's see, what was his phrase, something like selective outrage.
What does it say to you that the New York Times wouldn't print his objections?
Well, first, I wasn't surprised that they wouldn't. Frankly, I think it would have been smart if they had. We live in a day and age where it's all going to hit the web anyway. I didn't think it was very smart of the Times not to run it. I mean, if I was in their situation, I think I would have run it and then had a direct response from the editors in the form of a column right next to it. I mean, you know, at least do that online. I mean, if they didn't want to run it in the newspaper, why not run it on their own website and then, like, have a public forum of people responding to it? You know what I'm saying? I mean, today it's all going to get out there anyway. Loosen up.
I saw the trailer for this movie you wrote about recently called The Invention of Lying. The comedian who actually was at the center of it and starred in it is, you know, hands down very, very funny, Ricky Gervais. And yet I did not take away from the trailer that this was, at least according to his own press, this was a first ever completely atheistic movie with no concessions. How so?
Well, I haven't seen the film. I have read an entire massive folder about it, and I have read transcriptions of the key scenes. So what my column is actually about is not so much the content of that film, but why religious conservatives who have screamed bloody murder about films like The Da Vinci Code, The Golden Compass, or that screed from Bill Mayer, Religulous, why didn't they scream about this movie? Which leads to one of three conclusions, and we don't know which is possible. First of all, it could be they're growing up, and they realize that it's not going to do a whole lot of good. This isn't going to be that big of a movie. Second, they may have realized that, hey, all we're doing is giving publicity. You know, we're helping create PR for this guy. And the third possibility is that the creator of the film just made a horrible mistake by sneaking the religious or anti-religious content out. He may have gotten a few people into the theater who were genuinely shocked to find out that this movie had this very strong religious agenda, or anti-religious agenda, which I guess is another form of religious agenda. But at the same time, by sneaking it up on them, he didn't let the wider public that might have wanted to support that type of movie know what it was. Like you said, the trailers made it look like a kind of slightly edgy romantic comedy, right? There was no hint of this other agenda, which I guess means he blew it. He blew his shot at publicity. I found the whole thing kind of funny.
Could it also be that perhaps the crowd that is always ready to react so strongly to what they perceive as any anti-religious bias in any kind of pop media simply don't get that worried about something that doesn't do well at the box office?
Well, except that these things always happen in advance. I mean, you put the cart after the horse in that point. This thing sank at the box office so quickly. But, I mean, normally the Catholic League or somebody would have been reacting. Word about the film would have gotten out based on its early publicity campaigns. So in this case, maybe once they heard about it, they already saw it was a bomb, so they went, well, we're not going to help him. Or, you know, or why react? Just let it die. That's a possibility, but it doesn't explain why they ignored it in the first place. And so I don't have an answer for you.
Terry Mattingly is director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He writes the weekly On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service. He's founder of GetReligion.org, and he's author of the book Pop Goes Religion. We will link to Terry's column, On Religion column, at our website tonight under the On Demand page, issuesetc.org. Click On Demand. Terry, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for being our guest.
Thanks a bunch. Glad to talk Lutheran with you.
Well, a special thanks to Sandra in McLean, Virginia. She recently became a patron in the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. The Reformation Club is our monthly or annual giving program. You can either give monthly or annually. Consider joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club today. Go to our homepage, issuesetc.org. Look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Click on that, and you'll find out how you can become an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron. Those are the four levels. You can find out all about them at our website, issuesetc.org. Click the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. You'll see all the information there. It's the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., a conversation with former Miss California, Carrie Prejean. Back to the worship wars that we were talking about with Terry a little bit ago. Is it worth fighting for? There are those who look at it, and it is acrimonious. It can be very divisive in the church. There's no doubt about it. But the truth is worth dividing over. An error is worth responding to. Is it worth the battle? Is it worth the war? I think it is. When we are given the choice between retaining the faith once for all delivered to the saints, as it has been handed down to us by those very saints, in those very expressions that are rooted so firmly, so deeply in Scripture itself, that communicate so clearly, age in, age out, the gospel of Jesus Christ, his saving work, that leave prominent place for the preaching of law and gospel, for the baptism of sinners, for the administration of Christ's body and blood in the sacrament, for the pronouncement on a regular basis to sinners in need of his absolution, his forgiveness of sins. When we have a treasure like this, we dare not cast it aside. And when we consider what it is we're trading it for, how-to preaching, songs that sing more about me than about Jesus, preaching that preaches the Christian rather than the Christ, I don't think that there's any question here. And I think if it has to be a fight, it's worth the battle for the gospel. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.